You're listening to the Pride On podcast from the Civil Service LGBT Plus Network. It's June and it's Pride season, but this year things look very different, and I guess you could say that Pride is off. Well, not for us. We're keeping Pride on, and on this podcast you'll hear inspiring LGBT Plus civil servants talking about their lives, identities, and what Pride means to them. I'm John Piatt, I'm a civil servant, and for a while I ran this cross-government LGBT Plus network, but today I'm your host for this podcast. In this episode, I'll be joined by Lucy Pedrick, who works at the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, and I've known Lucy for a few years now, so when we decided to make this podcast, I just knew that I had to talk to her about this whole moment we're going through. When you hear her speak, it'll be obvious why, so let's get started. Hi, Lucy. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me today and welcome to the Pride On podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
You've been doing loads of work, particularly on bi inclusion and kind of highlighting intersectionality in lots of different contexts. But before we hop into talking about all of that, why don't we start by talking a bit about what you do in your day job? Because actually, you've got quite an interesting mix of jobs that you've been doing in your current department over the last 12 months or so, haven't you?
So I've been in the civil service now for I think about 3 years. I joined initially on secondment from a housing trade body, went to MHCLG. For the last 2 years, I've been in DCMS, working in our EU strategy team, managing complex cross-cutting policy issues relating to EU exit, so specifically things like immigration and borders. More recently, for the last 8 weeks, I've been surged to lead a team working on the COVID-19 response, the economic response specifically. I know lots of colleagues around Whitehall have done that too. But I'm actually shortly due to go to lead the fiscal events team for 12 months. So that's all very exciting.
Well, congratulations on your new role. As you'll know, and as people listening to this podcast will know, Pride events across the country have largely been cancelled. We probably won't have any Pride activities in the traditional form for this season. I always get very hesitant about calling it Pride Month because that kind of feels very American focused in that the Stonewall riots obviously happened in June, and so we commemorate those every year. But actually, kind of Pride is really a year-long activity now. But anyway, the activities that we normally would do, so things like parades and marches and those kinds of things across the country, aren't happening. Have you been thinking about how you're going to kind of celebrate and commemorate Pride this year in these socially distant times?
Yeah, I have. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's been lots of discourse over the last few years about Pride as a parade and whether we do that because it's a protest or because it's a party and a celebration. And I think not doing it as a parade and not being able to has really allowed us to focus our attentions on what Pride actually means to each of us as individuals. The original Pride came out of the Stonewall riots, as you've said, John, and that was about protest. And it was a coming together of a whole number of communities, but specifically Black, trans, sex working, homeless activists that were advocating for themselves, but also helped spearhead quite a lot of what was happening for kind of wider queer liberation. And I think particularly with what's been happening in the US at the moment, that's been at the forefront. And then on the flip side, when we're all experiencing the Pride season, as you say, John, in our living rooms and our bedrooms, in our shared houses and our normal living environments, being that focused on self and in your immediate community around you, or if you live on your own like I do, the isolation that you experience from being withdrawn from your community, it's really a very exciting and quite interesting opportunity, I think, for all of us to reflect on what Pride actually really means for us. And I don't think I have the answers to that question yet, to be honest, but I'm thinking about it and I'm enjoying the process of doing that thinking.
And is there anything that you're going to really miss about not being able to do Pride in the way that we normally do collectively?
I think I'll miss being the togetherness, the physical togetherness. There's something very powerful about walking alongside your LGBT siblings and walking through a space that is traditionally quite exclusionary. and owning that space. There's something incredibly powerful about that experience. And I certainly didn't really feel like I belonged to any LGBT community until I first went on a Pride march, and was walking in that way. There's something very powerful about that physical presence, and I will definitely, definitely miss that.
I suppose one of the downsides of Pride, though, in the way that it normally happens, is that there's very limited numbers of people that can normally take part in those things, because whilst they are kind of empowering and enriching environments, it's physically constrained by physical space. It's quite kind of difficult, even for people that don't experience multiple discriminations and intersections in their identity, to kind of go into those spaces. And I guess there's other people where you've got intersectional identities, and that makes it even more difficult to step into those spaces sometimes. Is that something that you've experienced personally, and any reflections on that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, there is something very empowering about that experience of being in the Pride, parade, but you also never notice quite how, it makes it very visible, those marginalizations and invisibilities, and particular challenges of accessibility of Pride. It comes to a crux in that parade. And some of that is about pure numbers, but others is about the way that we do that coming together. As a bisexual person, I've had conversations with a lot of bi people about Pride and at Pride, about the perceptions of whether or not that is a space for us if we happen to be in a mixed gender relationship at the time, a relationship that presents as being heterosexual. And there are some really, really biphobic views held by quite a lot of people who participate in the parades, who speak at the parades, who talk about the parades, that makes it feel quite an alienating environment. I mean, I've spent most of my adult life being single, so that hasn't really been an issue for me. But it's certainly something that I am really aware of in thinking about my future engagement with Pride. And then last year in particular, I don't know why last year more than others, but I found the noise and the colour and the bodies and the smell really overpowering, and I very nearly went into an autistic shutdown, and I realized I've just suddenly introduced a quite big part of my identity there. But in addition to being bi and being a woman, I'm also autistic, and I find that impacts me in lots of ways, but one of the ways it affects me is in my exposure to really intense sensory information. And it can make my brain basically start to close in on itself and turn off because it can't process all of that information quickly enough. And that's really hard to deal with. And my brain basically goes into survival mode, and I need to get out of there as soon as possible. And if you're in a pen full of thousands of people and you want to be there because the queer part of you is enjoying yourself, but actually your brain can't handle that much noise, it's quite challenging.
I suppose that's one of the positives of the things that the Civil Service LGBT Network and Pride organisations and lots of others are trying to do this Pride season, is actually create a much wider variety of things that people can engage with and that might be a bit more inclusive.
Exactly. Pride was a protest, but as we are learning right now in very real ways, there are lots of different ways of doing activism, and there are lots of different ways of marking and commemorating Pride season. Pride is not fairly corporatized marches through big cities. There are so many ways that we can celebrate Pride, and having the option of doing it in that way that's become quite kind of quintessential over the last few decades, having that mechanism taken away from us this year, I think is really forcing us to focus in on what some of those alternative models would be. And I'm quite excited to see what we learn from this year, and how we take that forward in future years. And I hope that we don't just go back to doing a kind of one size fits all of you can't mark your LGBT identity unless you do it in this really specific way.
Let's jump off from that point as well to talk about things that are a bit more wide than just Pride itself. So you've been involved in the civil service LGBT landscape for a number of years now, and have done quite a lot of excellent work with volunteers from across various departments on bi inclusion in particular. What was it that about the kind of landscape that exists across government that made you kind of want to do something specifically on bi inclusion? What was it that you felt that you weren't getting from the wider civil service in terms of recognizing and celebrating your identities?
That's a great question. I think any bisexual civil servants, and I use bisexual in the broadest sense here, listening to this podcast is go probably going to recognize some of this. Being bi, you have to come out to people all the time, And it's not the case of having the best of all worlds. You actually have the worst of all worlds, because you're too queer to fit in straight spaces, and you're too straight, and I use imaginary inverted commas around that, when you are in queer spaces. And I find myself having to come out over and over and over again, even if I go to like LGBT network drinks. And I think having bi people, particularly bi women, particularly intersectional bi people in leadership in LGBT networks in the civil service and in the wider corporate world is really important, for us to kind of just land that message that we are in the room, and you don't need to assume that we're a lesbian or assume that we're a gay guy, or in fact assume that we're cis when we walk into any room. So one of the things that I did was create a space that you may have heard of, Bi Space. We brought together a bunch of different civil servants in a room, with no agenda set in advance, other than the fact that it was to create some space for us to get together and be bisexual civil servants. And I cannot express to you, John, the power of walking into a room and not having to say, by the way, I'm bisexual, or not having to worry about what the other person that you were having a conversation with was thinking, because we knew as soon as we walked into that room that every person we encountered shared that part of our identity. And we had a completely different kind of conversation because of that, because none of us were carrying that burden. And I've not been involved hugely over the last year or so. I've been focused on some of my other kind of inclusion stuff and other work around the department. But seeing BioSpace grow and continue to create an environment for bio civil servants to get together and experience that power has been really exciting.
So I suppose one of the most interesting things to me as a kind of outside observer of bi space, and I identify as a gay man, so kind of wasn't heavily involved in the events, is that unlike a lot of the events that I would have tended to go to, where a lot of the people look like me and look like white gay men, there tended to be a lot more women or people that present their gender in a more feminine way that attended those bi space events. Why do you think that was?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that I think LGBT spaces, particularly in government for some reason, but actually frankly in any corporate environment, just generally are dominated by white cis gay men, which creates a feeling of exclusion even if it's not intentional, and makes that the experience of showing up to that event with a different set of identities quite challenging, and puts quite a lot of burden on you to do that. I think having a space that was intentionally a different LGBT space made it more accessible for those of us who are not cis white men to participate. I think there's also something about the fact that actually there's a huge amount of biphobia, specifically targeted towards bi men, that manifests quite differently to the biphobia that bi women experience, and the biphobia that non-binary bisexuals experience too. That means that actually fewer bi men feel safe to be out even amongst themselves, to be honest, and quite a lot of bi men that I know have spent quite a lot of their lives just deciding to own the gay label because it's easier and less stressful than being honest about who they are, given the amount of biphobia that persists. I mean, the other thing that I found really interesting about bi space was that it wasn't just different in its kind of gender profile compared with other LGBT events, but it was different across lots of intersectional divides. So we had really interesting conversations about the overlap, for some of our colleagues, of being both bisexual and biracial, and straddling two worlds across multiple different kind of axes of their lives. There were really interesting conversations about what it means to be bisexual and disabled, about what it means to be bisexual and have poor mental health. And by the way, if you're not aware listening to this podcast, bisexuals, across the whole of the population, consistently have poorer mental health outcomes than any other member of any other group, even within the LGBT community. And actually, what I found really fascinating was that by just saying we're coming together as bisexuals, suddenly all of these different people who you would never see normally in an LGBT space felt safe to be there. And I found that really exciting.
So that's probably a nice segue into allyship and the fact that sometimes as LGBT people we can get quite absorbed in the fact that we have an identity and we're marginalised too, I guess, and so don't really think about what we could be doing within our own community to be better allies to each other. Do you think that there's things that we're not doing collectively as a community of civil servants that are also LGBT to kind of support each other? And what more could we be doing as allies of LGBT people, even though we are LGBT?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just need to recognise that all of us, and I include myself in this as someone who is, you know, who's, I tick a number of different diversity boxes, but I do not tick them all. And I think we have to get more honest with ourselves and more humble, quite frankly, about those boxes that we don't tick, those spaces where we do hold privilege, where we're not marginalised, and be really honest with ourselves, with each other, with our communities about what that means about our experience, what that means about the power that we hold, and how that power manifests in the lives of other people who are more marginalised than we are. And I think right now, as a white person, I am feeling that more than ever. And I'm pretty angry with myself for not having felt it earlier. And I know that that's white guilt manifesting. And then that makes me angry with myself. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I've got to grapple with here, that I'm doing everything that I can to not bring my colleagues who are Black and other people of colour into, because they've got enough to be dealing with. But I think we need to make space within our communities to have those difficult conversations with ourselves and with each other, and recognise that power, confront it, and figure out what we're going to do practically, realistically, today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, for the rest of our lives, to champion and advocate and make space for everybody else who is more marginalized than us. And I mean that no matter how marginalized we might be. And it's really difficult to do that because none of us have endless supplies of energy, and sometimes you have to make choices about which battles you fight. But we shouldn't be choosing to not be mindful and thoughtful about what the impact of our actions are, even when they're kind of omissions rather than active things that we're doing that are creating problems. If we exist in the structures of power that operate in our society, we are doing harm to people unless we are consciously trying to undo that harm.
So I think that's really important that we do a bit of, I guess, introspection inside the LGBT community, inside the civil service, and more widely about what is it that we're doing to lift up the voices of people that are even more marginalised than we are. I guess one of the things that we really need to do as well is engage the people that aren't like us. What would be your message to non-LGBT people in the civil service about everything that's going on right now, and kind of the kind of things they should be doing as part of Pride and all year round to lift up and kind of amplify the voices of LGBT civil servants in their workplace?
I think the real message that I've learned is it can be summed up in a fairly simple mantra, actually, which is try again, fail again, fail better. And that's the approach that I'm trying to take with the thinking that I'm doing about how to become, through the course of my life, more of an anti-racist. I've recently just set up a book group with some of my friends and people who kind of follow me on social media, where we are going to do the work or try and do the work of unlearning some of our racism. And our mantra is try again, fail again, fail better. I think we have to confront the fact that we are all going to make mistakes. We have to get comfortable with making those mistakes, and we have to get comfortable with the discomfort of having those mistakes pointed out to us. And to do that in a way that kind of isolates ourselves a bit and provides a bit of a buffer and insulation from the communities that we're working with and trying to be allies for. I think one of the biggest mistakes that I see, and that I make myself continually, is that when we try and do allyship, we try and do it by kind of entwining ourselves so closely with the communities that we're working with, that we put the stress and the process that we're going through to become better allies on them. And we don't think about the fact that that's just creating more work for people who are already doing more emotional labor than anybody else. And I think we need to get better at saying, you know, I don't need to speak to this friend who happens to be bisexual, or who happens to be disabled, or who happens to be Black. I don't need to talk to them about how I become a better ally for them when Google exists. Like, the internet is out there. People have been writing about this stuff for decades. I'm going to go away. I'm going to do my reading. I might come to that friend if they are genuinely one of my friends and say, I've come up with a bit of a plan. Do you think I've selected some useful things? Testing it and getting some kind of quality assurance is one thing, but going to someone and saying, I've decided I want to be your ally and I don't know where to start. Please, can you help me? It's not the helpful thing that we think it is. And I think we need to get a bit more real and a bit more honest with ourselves about that. And quite frankly, just be a bit more humble. So yeah, try again, fail better. It's going to become the kind of marching anthem for this year, definitely, but hopefully for the rest of my life. I think that is allyship for me.
That's the end of this episode of the Pride On podcast. Thank you to Lucy Pedrick for taking the time to speak to me about those really important issues. If you're not already, you can subscribe to this podcast on all of your favourite podcasting platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can find out more about the Civil Service LGBT Plus Network at www.civilservice.lgbt and add/pride for all the latest information about this year's Pride activities. You can follow us at CSLGBT on Twitter, at CivilServiceLGBT on Instagram, and visit facebook.com/CivilServiceLGBT for all the latest updates. Until next time, thanks very much for listening.